Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the podcast. It is Friday, the 24th of July. Seven more days remaining in July and the year that just keeps on going and going and going and going. Also, what's going is Jen and I every Friday. Jen, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, I'm well. So last week, you and I talked about the Finder's Cult. And we're going to continue a little bit about that because I think that it's really important. And I feel as if maybe some people that were involved in it are trying to start over again. And at that same time period when 1987, when they were doing this, at this, you know, simultaneous to that was something called the Franklin Credit Union scandal, which kind of extended out. And to me, is something that brought in every single bit of media and some splashy front page headlines on national news, which you didn't really get with the Finders. People were obsessed with the Finders, and it is still the number one most requested thing, I guess, in FBI Vault. So, I mean, people are into the Finders. But I wonder, you know, I had some thoughts about the Finders this week. And one of them is, why are things still redacted? You know, if there was nothing to anything, you know, you're talking about something that was 30 plus years ago, and these documents that keep coming out are still have redacted portions. And why is that? Is it because there's somebody who's still working that's active, maybe with the CIA or something, and you know, they have something to do with it? Is it about CIA training methods when you're talking about Marion and what the, you know, his company?
It could be a medley of things. You know, if you have someone that is mentioned in those documents that is still active, or someone that, say, is not active, but they're linked to other people that are, and it, and exposing them could cause a domino effect. You wouldn't want that. So that would cause a redaction. Also, if it was ongoing training, they don't want you to know that kind of stuff.
You know, and also I looked at the, it was like the Tallahassee newspaper, and they had run many, many articles about the Finders.
The Tallahassee Democrat, they covered the whole Finders Keepers extensively.
They did. And so they did. You're 100% correct. And then what happened was, so when you had the 300 pages that were released, and, you know, the Tallahassee Democrat then did a follow-up with those 300-plus pages, and the article was maybe three-quarters of a page long. It's as if they just said, you know, we're done with this, and they didn't offer any insight into anything that was released. They didn't – and I just – it was kind of as if they said, nothing here anymore. Let's just move on and do something else. And I was kind of disappointed, and maybe because of the gap between – when it happened and when those documents were released. But yeah, I would have thought that it would have spurred on some more investigation and some more questions and things, because you did have 300, you know, plus page documents that were, you know, finally released. So
yeah, the situation was well documented, but you had DC Metro Police, the FBI, the State Department, Customs, all of them were saying there's no corroborating evidence as to the Finders, A, being a cult or being involved in any type of rituals or abuse. So maybe the newspapers or media in general felt that they had to walk a fine line, you know, maybe not to get sued or not to mislead the public, because that Tallahassee Democrat, they really stick to facts when they deliver their story. So I don't think they have a direction to go.
If you think about it, with all the things that are in the FBI vault, that Finders is the number one searched term in there. Now, I don't know if that's still true with all of the Epstein things, if Finders is still number one. But it just shows that people still have a lot of unanswered questions about what was going on. And one of the people that could provide answers, perhaps, is the founder of it, Marion Pettit. And he gave an interview for a book. And one of the things I want to do is just kind of go over it. A lot of it feels like rambling, but then every once in a while he'll throw out a nugget. And I feel that is pretty much how the Finders operate. And they asked, you know, how far back can you trace the origins of the finders? And he said, you know, I had two apartments back in the 30s and 40s in Washington. And then I thought to myself, just with this very first answer, in the 30s and 40s, and this is after 1987, so let's say 1937. So he had it for 50 years before, you know, this happened, and then, you know, it just seemed like a really long, long time. And he said that he just had an open house, and that it was supported by the gift economy, and that he would throw something in, and he said it goes back that far. And then he said, four people here with me now have been with me for over 25 years. And then he said, I kept another thing called the Free State back in the hippie period, back in the mountains here. And they said, the Free State. And he said, yeah, it was the Free State. And it was known all over the world. And they said, well, where's that? And he said, about 20 miles from here. So I'm guessing that he's referring to the Culpeper, Virginia place. Yeah. Which is, you know, a suburb of Washington, D.C. And he said that about 100 people would usually be there at any time. And then he said, this is kind of odd. He mentions, you know, a few other people have done that, as in keeping an open house kind of thing. And he said, a man named Gottlieb, have you ever heard of him? A musician. He kept an open house like that, and then the government came out and closed him down. And I was just like, the government closed him down. Was this something? Was he in competition? Did the government not, you know, like two of these things going on? He didn't say the police. He said the government. And whenever I hear somebody say the government, I'm, you know, if a cop pulls you over for speeding, you don't go, the government pulled me over for speeding, right?
Right.
You say, you know, the police pulled me over. So it's interesting that the government came and closed him down. And then he said, but I was allowed to keep doing what I was doing. And where he's talking about rambling, because the person goes, well, this was the 1940s. He goes, no. We've moved up to the 60s here. and, you know, it's this kind of thing. And he said, before that, just to give you an idea of the time period, the sheriff came out and put a gun on me one day and said, show me some ID. I showed it to him, and he says, oh, I know you. You're the guy what keeps beatniks. So I kept open house to beatniks. And then he goes, we're talking about the 50s now. And I'm just confused. We, you know, we've gone to the 30s, the 60s, the 50s, the 40s. And this is just kind of all disinformation. These people who are interviewing are probably like, what are we doing? You know, it's just kind of crazy. But then he says, going back to World War II, I kept open house mainly to intelligence and counterintelligence people in Washington, OSS people passing through, things like that. So the open house at that time was more or less at that level. And so it just shows that he does have this, if you're believing what he says, going back to World War II, so let's say the 40s, and by the time the two men have the encounter with the Tallahassee police, it's 1987, so essentially almost 50 years of, you know, intelligence and things like that. And you have to remember also that the OSS, which became the CIA, was much more open to anything that they could do to stop, you know, communism or the Soviet Union and any kind of ideas. And I think it's basically OSS people that thought up things like MK Ultra and stuff like that.
Sure. They were experimental, and they liked the social experiments as well, which Pettit might be a part of that, you know, with him having an open house and having all these different people come in, and then what he goes on to do with the finders. That too sounds like not only a cover, but a social experiment.
Yeah, and because he had, so, you know, to go back, he has this house in Washington, D.C. He's got a warehouse in Washington, D.C. Then he's got the property out in Culpeper. And, you know, the interviewers were asking him, so it's different than Kerouac and Ginsberg and all this kind of stuff, referring to beatniks. And he goes, I just keep open house. That's about all I do. It changes as people show up. Basically, we have about 600 acres up there. That's
a lot. Which
I
thought was interesting. He referred to as the farm.
Yes. Which, of course, the CIA training facility is also known as the farm.
Exactly. So he calls himself the student, the stroller, the pathfinder. And if you look further into the finders, they say that they believe in the writings of the Chinese philosopher Lao Tzu. And when you look at what that guy was talking about, it's like harmony, free will, deep wisdom. And then it talks about the art of government, whether over country or child. So
exactly.
When you look at the finders having kids, you know, it you have to kind of look at this Chinese philosopher, and it might fill in some of the gaps as to what they were up to.
And by the way, if you're going from downtown D.C. to Culpeper, you have to zip right past Langley. So that's another thing that it's kind of in the way. But they would ask him these questions, and he said that that we have a few houses there, people who are more or less permanently there now. They spend part of the time in Culpeper, part of the time in Washington, D.C., and part of the time up in the mountains, and another part traveling all over the world. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, I don't understand any of this, because you guys are just supposed to be some kind of group of beatniks, but then, you know, you have people living essentially in a safe house or a farm, as you referred to it, in Culpeper, where obviously if you have 600 acres, you have a way to, you know, really get yourself a field of fire. You have a way to protect yourself. 600 acres is a lot. You can see people coming from a long way away. And then he mentions this place up in the mountains, and then another part traveling all over the world. And I'm assuming, going by all the telexes and everything that our customs inspector found in part one, that it has to do with these kids and people and transporting things. And you can't just tell me that it's all a game when people found the telexes and stuff. Now, you could say, oh, we don't really mean them as people. We mean as nuclear weapons or something like that. But it just, it doesn't sound like that at all.
And the kid thing is weird, because when the kids were taken originally into, let's call it CPS custody, I think it was just Department of Human Services back then, these kids had to be shuttled around to different facilities because lots of threatening phone calls kept coming in from the members of the finders, and they were just threatening all kind of stuff. And so they had to put the kids actually under protection of armed guards, and that's in the FBI vault. So if there is nothing to all this, and they weren't doing anything with the kids weren't valuable, why all the threats?
You know, one thing I noticed is Jen found a whole bunch of original the investigator's notes and things like that. And one thing I didn't notice until I was studying for this second part was the kids' names. Like, one was named Bee, one was named Honeybee. Just very kind of generic things. And it just, I found that to be odd. And I don't remember the other kids' names that I saw, but I just, that caught my attention. I said, okay, so we're going to name you Bee, and then we're going to name you Honeybee.
Yeah, how original. But you know what it reminded me of is that in human trafficking, the first thing they do is they strip you of your identity, and they give you either a number or they give you a crazy name like Fantasia or, like you said, Honeybee. So
yeah, because
that makes me wonder what they were studying or what that experiment was about.
Because there's nothing, like you said, you're stripping away. This person has no identity. Their name is just Honeybee or Bee. And so when they disappear, let's just for giggles, that they were sold somewhere. Let's say they were found in a country several years. Do you know your name? No. Do you sure? I think my name was Honeybee. You know, you can't trace that to anything.
Right. And that's what a lot of these kids were saying per the documents. The law enforcement was asking them, what is your last name? And the eldest, Mary, she said, I don't know. But she assumed that one of the men that were apprehended was a father, one of them, one or the other. The other kids, they didn't really know much of anything. It was Mary who said, this is Bee and this is Honeybee. And she's kind of like the little kid spokesperson. So, yeah, the adults are confused and the kids are confused. But that's the game, right?
Yeah, because then the police have no idea what they're doing.
Right. Because so this Marion Pettit was probably trained to make riddles and games and things that he learned in the OSS and things he learned from intelligence officers. And he too was an intelligence officer, allegedly.
I fully 100% subscribe to that.
Because I mean, his son, don't forget, was in the Air America, the propriety of the CIA flying. So, I mean, he was in intelligence too. It seems like an intelligence family. The mom.
His wife worked for the CIA, yeah. I mean, exactly. And so these interviewers, they say, so they're really confused. You can tell. I mean, this is a book that's been edited, and the questions are, so they're saying, so, but basically it's just kind of a drift in, drift out thing. And he goes, nobody signs anything. That's not answering kind of any kind of question whatsoever. And it feels totally, you know, as if he's just kind of playing them along. And, you know, then he starts talking about, like you said, Lao Tzu. And then he said, I thought you guys were actually two ministers because they were going to come over here and pray for me. And I thought you two might have been them.
So he plays those Charles Manson games where he has periods of sanity and then periods of insanity. And you can't tell if he's just crazy or crazy like a fox. To me, that is just all a game, all a cover story. The CIA went on to deny that there was any cover up. They did admit that something went wrong, but that's as far as they took it. And they called it a non-story. The finders themselves, you know, after DHS came out and said that at least two of the children had been sexually abused, the New York Times was like, okay, well, what happened to that report? And the finder spokesperson, Diane Sherwood, she comes out and says, look, if there was any kids that were molested or had anything done to them, it wasn't while they were in the care of the finders. That had to be something previous. That had to be something that has nothing to do with us because we don't do that. And to me, that makes it sound like that this group, being all up in the CIA and intelligence and stuff, maybe they were practicing how to move humans. You know, how does this work? How does it connect? Who can you connect with? You know, like building just a big web because they're adamant that they didn't do anything wrong.
And they had books about that and stuff. I have a question, and because you detail and research way more than me on this. Was there ever any proof that these kids, that the mom, the quote unquote moms that came forward, were they actually the parents?
Did I don't know. I never read anything about DNA reports, but I know
or birth certificates or anything. And on the birth certificate, does it say honeybee?
I doubt it. They probably cloaked the kids in, you know, anonymous names just to preserve their dignity, you know, because the media was covering this. I don't know about DNA and stuff like that. I imagine that was covered through the court system. And the children would have had a guardian ad litem. That person would have made sure that the moms were legitimately the moms because none of these organizations wanted to return these kids back to these people. But with it being bio moms and bio dads, they had to. They had no reason to hold them. Two kids, though, were kept in foster care. All returned but two.
And were those two the ones that had been sexually abused?
Yes.
Okay.
Per documents.
So then these people, these interviewers, they say, there's a church next door. That's got to be difficult. And he goes, how so? And the interviewer goes, well, I was thinking in terms of having a bohemian crowd around. Also, that's a real thing to infiltrate in terms of the intelligence agencies. First of all, these interviews are really focused on the bohemian. And I think he's saying, you know, I don't have anything to do with the bohemian so much. You know, this is an intelligence thing and you guys are talking about beatniks. But his answer says, some investigators back in the 60s tailed me for 4 years. At first, they said they thought I was a dope dealer big time because I didn't use it myself. Then they decided that I was a front for the CIA. They asked if I was a front for the CIA. Of course, I wouldn't have told them anyway, but I asked these people. They said they ran the name through the computer, and they said, no, we don't own that guy. So then the investigator says, I've been working on you for 4 years, and I can't figure out what you're doing. What the hell are you doing? And he says, so the point is that actually I'm not doing anything. I'm just enjoying life and working on good ideals all the time.
So he's already called in a white lie because the CIA would never confirm nor deny that anyone did or did not work for them. So he's already lied at least once.
And who are these investigators?
Right.
That are
who
trailing
are they?
For 4 years?
Because you know, he goes on to flip around and say that he himself is an investigator who has been investigating the CIA. And he did it better than anyone. He infiltrated them. He figured out what they were about, although he never goes on to say what he's about. So, I mean, this guy is all over the map. You know, one minute he works for the CIA. The next minute he is the anti-CIA. When you look at the Terrell Finders member, he does a lot of interviews. His are just as weird.
They are. And I'm going to go over one of his interviews in a bit because he is somebody that I feel is trying to start a Finders all over again. And then they ask him about Wilhelm Reich and the Reichian people. And it feels like as if this is something that's one of his Marion's sweet spots. And he says, oh, you know, I read most of those books. I'd say that I had interest. And then they talk about some conspiracy related to Nelson Rockefeller and things like that. And but then they get to this question, just straight out. Good question. What do you make then of these stories that connect the Finders up to a pedophilia ring in the CIA? And this is his answer. The pedophiles and all that stuff. And that's not an answer. That's just, I made a statement and I'm going to see if you follow up with something. You know, he just wants to see, I guess, what they're saying. And they go, well, so that's all a smear. And then he goes, I just kept open house to a lot of the counterintelligence and intelligence people over the years. I've been reported to their security officers probably plenty of times for trying to find out what's going on in the world. I've tried all of my life to get behind the scenes in the CIA. I sent my wife in as a spy to spy on the CIA for me. She was very happy about it, happy to tell me everything she found out. She was in a key place, you know, with the records, and she could find things out for me. And my son worked for Air America, which was a proprietary of the CIA. There's some connections, but not to me personally. And my thing is, if it says I've been reported to their security officers probably plenty of times, but he has counterintelligence, which would seem to indicate probably FBI, and intelligence people, which would indicate CIA, that he's had them all over his house. Well, the CIA must know that. It's not, I mean, he kind of is behind the scenes in the CIA. Why do these random counterintelligence and intelligence people just want to hang out at his house?
And the fact that he was a chauffeur for, you know, during the war for top lieutenants, obviously he was very well connected to the intelligence. Like you said, he had people over to his home. His story is not even remotely believable. That cover is blown. Whatever these people were truly up to, and getting paid finder's fees, you know, what were they finding? You know, what loopholes in the system, you know, like how to traffic, how to move people, how finance moves. I mean, were they just watching everything? And I would just question, who were they watching it for? You know, is he truly a spook? Or, I mean, is he a kook? Because, I mean, just because you used to work in intelligence doesn't mean that that goes on for a lifetime. So was he really honestly working as an operative for the CIA, or was he just playing and they were telling him, hey, since we know you and we have some history, you know, knock it off.
So it's a guy who hangs out with cops and thinks he's a cop, but he's really not.
Right.
You know, something kind of like that. Because, and then, you know, they go back and forth about CIA and Office of Naval Intelligence and stuff. And then they ask him specifically about Florida. And he says, it's very simple. We had the kids, and the general idea was that they would go up to the country up there, 20 miles from here, and they would go to school, a self-governing school. Adults would be available to them, intelligence, well-balanced people, and they would never be alone with the kids, so then no one could accuse them of any pedophile stuff. At least two would have to be there. As far as I know, they did all that. Then they were just taking them on a camping trip to Florida. There were four intellectuals with them, and they just happened to drive into a park, and somebody was suspicious because the two men were well-dressed. They had four people with them on the trip, and they were all well-educated, well-balanced people, so I don't think there was any funny stuff going on. So who were the other two people? Do we know? Because we know about Houlihan and whatever his name, Ammerman or something, but he's saying that there was four people.
There's a whole list of finders, both male and female. And
I know, but that were on that trip. So, you know, that's
I don't know about who was exactly on the trip.
Exactly. So we don't
only
know
talk
if he's
about the two
up.
Men in the van, and it's the two men that you listed.
Yeah. And then, you know, surveillance and counterintelligence. And he goes, you know, in the 60s, I was under surveillance from 64 to 68. And he just goes on and on and on and on. And then they ask him about the computer training center. And he goes, well, there's some partial truth to that. We go out and do emergency services and get employment for a lot of people. And the man didn't know it, but he was so-called hiring a finder. And the company was actually doing training for the CIA. But it looks like on the surface that it all ties together, even though it's a temporary worker, you know, so, and that's kind of the only thing that the CIA admitted to, right? Was just this one person who was teaching a training class, and that was their only association with the finder.
Yeah, just the technology aspect, because they were using technology that for that time period was high tech, and it was something that any agency would want to be a part of or learn about.
So, you know, when Marion retired, and I think that we're not 100% sure that he's dead, right?
Allegedly, he died in 2014. I don't see, you know, any proof of where anyone went to a funeral or anything. Why would he not be dead, though?
He's certainly old enough to be dead, for sure. I wanted to read to you this interview that the other founder of the cult did, and of course I'm not going to be able to find it because that's just not going to happen.
These finders, you know, after the actual finder group, it busted up. They branched out, and like you said, the guy you're going to talk about, he goes on to start his own thing. A lot of these people were hooked to the National Press Club, they're journalists, so they're still traveling about. One lady in particular, she gets around, and she's still to this day linked to intelligence, and some of the things that she's involved with are questionable. So when these things break down, you know, do they ever really stop? It doesn't appear to. They get a new breath of life, I guess, with some different people.
So, of course, like, oh, you know what? I know where I can find it. Hold on one second. So this guy, his name is Toby Terrell. We talked about him last week. And in 2014, he gave an interview, and he gave it to, I want to give credit for it, to NPR and in Gainesville, Florida. And they don't ask him, and this is Gainesville, which is not very far from Tallahassee, and they don't ask him any questions about the finders at all. It's as if they don't know that he's related or anything like that. And so it turns out that he had started a Zen hostel. And he said that, you know, the article goes on and says, residents and travelers gather outside at a long table or inside the kitchen when it gets too cold. And during the meeting, they can ask any questions they have about life, meditation, and even where the toilet paper is kept. And then everybody gets to, you know, talk, or they can say pass and things like that. And Toby Terrell, 78 at the time, says he started the hostel in 2004 as a Zen center that offered hospitality, but the name Zen Hostel stuck. He said that after staying at a Zen center in Virginia for 20 years, he wanted to create his own center in Gainesville near his hometown. So I'm assuming that that Zen center in Virginia is the finders.
Absolutely, because this guy goes on to say that he shared a toothbrush with Marion Pettit for 20 years. And he goes on to talk about how he was married and he had kids, and he left all of that behind for the finders because he needed more enrichment in his life. So that's the kind of person he is.
And remember what Marion always said, that everything was kind of a gift economy or whatever. The hostel houses travelers as well as more permanent residents who have lived there for a few years. It operates on a gift economy, so people can give money or decide to volunteer their labor in exchange for staying. And, you know, so it just, to me, it kind of feels like it's the same kind of thing where he has people that are living there for a longer period than you have people who are dropping in and out. It almost sounds like he's trying to reconstruct what was the finders. And I worry that there's going to be somebody there, because there's a lot of 20 and 30 year olds who take that. And then the next thing you know, we're going to have another finders.
Oh, yeah. This should be looked into for years. You know, anytime you have cults or groups, anything counterculture pop up like that, they're monitored. You know, whether intelligence is involved or not, they're monitored, because you don't know which way they're going to go, or, you know, when one dies, who's going to be the next leader. And, you know, that can get crazy.
Plus, I don't think that, has anybody ever followed up on, you know, any of these kids or anything, or the, you know, what happened to them? You know, because when it all kind of disappeared after a year, when all the charges were dropped, everybody just kind of went back to their normal life. And you don't see very many 1990, 1991 articles, anybody following up on this story that kind of gripped the nation. Oh, what happened to the kids and the finders? No reporters.
I haven't seen anything from it. I've seen people try to hunt the kids down, and the three that they know the full names, their parents are linked to intelligence, so they're not going to talk. Those kids have been taught from an early age not to speak to anyone. As far as the other kids, I don't know what their names are or how people would possibly track them down, unless they had the unredacted papers from the FBI vault with, you know, full names.
So that was in 1987, and it continued up until 1988. And then one of the things, and beyond really, but one of the things that kind of came out from that, and I've always heard of the Franklin Credit scandal, but I always knew about the sex and the prostitution and the things in the White House kind of stuff. But it, you know, it was actually started off as just this guy essentially raiding the Franklin Credit Union for his own personal good. And, you know, spending money like crazy. But one of the things that happened was when the it happened in Nebraska. And the Nebraska state legislature started kind of looking into it because, you know, it's a credit union and it's collapsing. And the legislature, when this was happening, had already adjourned. And so there was this executive board. And the executive board, you know, they get called into session and they're there just, they think they're just dealing with a credit union's collapse. And I think that was on a Friday. And then by the end of the day, Monday, the next thing you know, they are looking into everything and they have had their minds blown over the weekend, completely blown over the weekend. So this, a lot of times you'll hear things about Franklin. Oh, you know, there's a lot of people who said a lot of things and maybe their stories weren't true. Maybe. Sure. I gotcha. But this was a Friday night where they're looking into a credit union, collapsing and have no witnesses or interview. They're just looking at documents. And then on Monday, their minds are blown. And they call the Omaha office of the FBI, because they've received reports of sexual abuse and they're looking at criminal inquiries and things like that. And they thought, okay, well, maybe child prostitution was involved. How vast was it? If foster homes were involved, which ones? Then the special agent in charge of the FBI's Omaha office said there was money laundering, but he wouldn't, elaborate on that. And then the state senator who was in charge of it said that drugs were involved, but nobody's saying all the details. They're just child prostitution, foster homes, money laundering, drugs. And everyone's like, great. What else? What can you tell us? And it's just this stuff. And I think that they were just so overwhelmed, by everything that was going on that they were kind of freaked out a little bit. And one of the person who was in charge of this credit union was this guy named Lawrence King. And at the time, he was 44. And by the way, because I don't want to forget, regardless of any child prostitution and all the other stuff that probably went on, the guy stole $40 million and he got 10 years in jail. And that's it. So he's out. He's living his life. He's living in Washington, D.C., apparently. But he was 44 at the time, and he owned a whole bunch of businesses, which probably were not legit. You know, he's married, got kids, and all this kind of stuff. And in 1972, he had been head of a national political organization called Black Democrats for George McGovern, and then he switched parties, went over to the Republicans, and somehow managed to, on a $16,000 a year salary. $16,000 and something. He managed to afford a $5,000 a month residence in Washington, D.C. He hosted this party where they filmed Dallas and where he spent $100,000. So this is a guy that's obviously living well above his means. And the way he was doing that was just kind of stealing from the credit union. I mean, he owed $1 million to American Express. $150,000 to limousine services in Omaha. I mean, come on. You can't drive your car in Omaha. And New Orleans and New York City, there's $120,000 for car leases. And remember, these are 1988 dollars. $60,000 to jewelry stores, $45,000 to a charter plane service, all of these kind of things. The payments for 13 months was $4.6 million.
Yeah, and lavish lifestyle does not equate to the income he was bringing in. So when you look at someone like him, and then you look at the Franklin Credit Union, I mean, yeah, he smelled bad. You could tell he was into something.
And the problem was, is that he had there was a chief accountant, and the chief accountant back in 1976, and we're talking this is 1988-ish when all this is breaking, he saw that King was stealing money. So what he did was he just said, okay, you're going to steal, I'm going to steal. And so the two of them just, you know, stole by themselves, and they would draft these phony ledger cards at night, and they would rub the cards on the office carpet to make them look older. And essentially they were spending more than they could get in. So then they decided to set up a boiler room where salesmen were selling certificates of deposit at these hugely high interest rates. And of course they're selling them, but they have to pay the interest rate. So essentially they've set themselves up for a Ponzi scheme. But the thing is, they managed to go for 7 or 8 years after they started that boiler room. And when they finally crashed in November 1988, their books had not been audited in 4 years. This is something where people just, because he was spending so much money, spending it with the right people, spending it on politicians, whenever somebody would say something, he would just send a politician their way, and the next thing you know, it would all be hushed up.
It wasn't his money, so he could afford to pay his way out of things. And then when you look at the, basically the back end of, if there were parties, who allegedly attended the parties, prominent publishers, people in the media, top law enforcement officials, judges, columnists, I mean, you name it, politicians for days. So, of course, they would help cover for someone who was spreading the wealth.
And where this kind of started to turn an ugly corner was investigators started looking, obviously, at all the expenses. But there's a quote, I think it might be from the Washington Post. It's either Post or New York Times. It says, King liked to share the wealth, particularly with his young male friends. For example, according to the World Herald, he reportedly gave a $2,800 deerskin coat, an 18-karat gold bracelet to 29-year-old Charlie Rogers, who later blew his own brains out with a shotgun. Another young man told the newspaper that King wanted to own you, a sugar daddy thing. Over 2 years, he bought me $2,500 in clothes and $23,000 in furniture. A third man recounted flying with King to Los Angeles to buy a $23,000 crystal chandelier for King's house. And then King said, oh, these are lies. It's just uttered by scum. But, you know, when you've got that many people essentially telling you the same kind of story, then people are going to start talking. And so then what happened is that a social worker in June of 1988, so this is, you know, right before the whole thing went down, she's at a mental hospital in Omaha, and she reports allegations of possible child abuse to the Nebraska Foster Care Review Board. And then the board asked Omaha police and the state attorney general to investigate possible child exploitation, a child prostitution ring. And the name that came up was this Larry King guy. And just out of nowhere, I mean, this is before it all went down. This is before anything made the news. This is just people talking. So this is not something that was predicated upon, oh, I want to be famous, and I saw it in a newspaper. And one teenage girl said that, quote, she had sat naked at parties and that men engaged in sexual activity, although penetration was not allowed. Another girl told of witnessing a murder. And then after the credit union was closed, finally a state senator said, okay, yeah, there's child abuse. And, but the thing is, nobody did anything. And they did nothing despite the fact that one witness passed 4 polygraph tests. And it just, it's kind of like it just went away. And, you know, people were asking, well, you know, were there airplane tickets? Were there other kind of charges? Were the minors transported across state lines? Was, you know, was any of this even there? Now here's the crazy thing. So you had this state senator that I talked about earlier, who was in charge of everything. And she wanted somebody to be in charge of this investigation. And she lost the vote. The person that she wanted to be in charge was the former CIA director, William E. Colby. Instead, the people decided on a lawyer based out of Lincoln, Nebraska. And he tried to untangle everything. So that person was in charge. And after 6 months, they produced 21 hours of testimony from 3 new witnesses, all in their early 20s, who said that as minors, they had been victims of physical and sexual abuse. They described lurid sex parties and named 24 people who had either committed abuses or at least attended these parties. So you have all of these people that are listed. And, you know, the people said, no, it wasn't me. It wasn't me. I didn't do it. You know, this isn't true. And this kind of goes on for a few months. And then you have one of the most spectacular headlines that I have ever seen in the history of headlines. And it was from the Washington Times in June of 1989. And I mean, it's pretty spectacular. It said, hold on, let me get up to the top. Homosexual prostitution inquiry ensnares VIPs with Reagan and Bush. Call boys took midnight tour of White House. This is above the fold, front page in the Washington Times on Thursday, June 29th, 1989. And that's not a headline you see every day.
Definitely not. But the politicians, they hit back immediately. They called it a carefully crafted hoax. And they said it was completely scripted by people who just had considerable knowledge of the people and the institutions around Omaha, because the boys, they assumed, were going to be coming from the boys' town, which was an orphanage in right. the area at the time. So they blamed it on that. They said those kids were just spurned, and politicians were plucked out and picked on just for personal reasons, you know, personal gain.
The article starts off, it says, a homosexual prostitution ring is under investigation by federal and district authorities and includes among its clients key officials of the Reagan and Bush administrations, military officers, congressional aides, and U.S. and foreign businessmen with close social ties to Washington's political elite, documents obtained by the Washington Times reveal. One of the ring's high-profile clients was so well-connected, in fact, that he could arrange a middle-of-the-night tour of the White House for his friends on Sunday, July 3rd of last year. So that would have been right in the thick of this. Among the six persons on the extraordinary 1 a.m. tour were two male prostitutes. Federal authorities, including the Secret Service, are investigating criminal aspects of the ring and have told male prostitutes and their homosexual clients that a grand jury will deliberate over the evidence throughout the summer, the Times learned. Now, here's where, well, you said when people say no. I mean, the reporters from the newspaper, they said that they examined hundreds of credit card vouchers. And from corporate and personal cards, made payable to the escort service operated by this ring. And many of the vouchers were run through what they call a sub-merchant, which was Chambers Funeral Home, by a son of the owner of Chambers Funeral Home. And apparently the company didn't know that they were doing it. And so these reporters have seen all these names, have seen the credit card records, and they were government officials, locally based U.S. military officers, businessmen, lawyers, bankers, congressional aides, and other professionals. And the editors of the Times said the newspaper would print only the names of those found to be in sensitive government posts or positions of influence, and that they didn't want to just publish names just, you know, to publish them.
Well, the thing is that they never really produced any – there was supposed to be like closed circuit – you know, videotaping of these parties and things like that. That never actually surfaced, or did it? Because when you look at the case of the former FBI chief, Ted Gunterson, that is going to be the guy who was linked to not only the Finders, but the Franklin scandal, who allegedly died of bladder cancer, although his personal physician told someone that it might have been arsenic poisoning. And Gunterson himself said that he knew he had tested positive in the past for arsenic and cyanide poisoning. And it's because he poked his head into all of this. And he was one of the people that was considered as owning a low-grade videotape that was called the blockbuster of what reveals what these participants were involved with. So if anyone had evidence, it was this Gunterson guy.
And he ends up dead.
Yeah, and he dies.
So of arsenic. And didn't you tell me last week that John Stitchers guy or whatever died of?
Yeah, there's another Metro police officer that allegedly died under mysterious circumstances. I'm still looking for his autopsy report. Everyone keeps sending stuff to me and saying that, you know, yes, it's true and all of that. But his family just has not made that information public. So if we get it, then, you know, we'll post it or talk about it. But as of right now, you know, that's just a conspiracy. But with this guy, I mean, he really did die, this Gunterson.
So the office of the U.S. Attorney General at that time, J. Stevens, who was a former deputy White House counsel to President Reagan, said that he was coordinating federal aspects of the inquiry, but refused to discuss the investigation or grand jury actions. And probably one of the reasons is that several former White House colleagues of Mr. Stevens were listed among clients of the prostitution ring. And those persons confirmed that the charges were theirs. And so then the attorney general said that, you know, they would cooperate with the Times Inquirer, and then they withdrew the offer and they declined to say whether Mr. Stevens would recuse himself from the case because of the conflict of interest.
These Washington men, as if they don't have enough to do.
I know. And then there was one highly placed Bush administration official and a wealthy businessman who procured the prostitutes from the escort services, and they were cooperating with the investigations. And the clients who were charged services for these escorts were a guy who was the former associate director of presidential personnel in the Reagan administration, a guy who was the labor secretary's political personnel liaison to the White House, who had previously been a congressional aide to Robert Bauman, who had resigned from the house after admitting having engaged in sexual liaisons with teenage male prostitutes. And this guy, Mr. Dutcher, the one who's referred, he also worked on the staff of Vice President Dan Quayle. I mean,
yeah,
these are...
That looks bad.
It does.
All of it.
And then there was a charge from a White House staffer who prepared the president's daily news summary. And then another guy named Craig Spence, who's a Washington socialite and international trade consultant, who engaged in sexual activities, and he spent upwards of $20,000 a month, and these are 1988 dollars, for male escorts who provided sex to him and his friends, said to include military personnel who also acted as his bodyguards. He was the one who arranged the nighttime tour of the Reagan White House. And sometimes he would make charges against his card several times a day. And all of this comes from this Franklin Credit Union. In Omaha, we're all shut down because the FBI has such a lid on it. Because think about, you have King, who, you know, has his stable of guys. And those stable of guys are the same guys that are the escorts for all of these other people. And then you have all of the stuff that's going on locally in Omaha with, you know, the orphans and such. But this is just... kind of crazy. There was this guy, Mr. Spence, several times a day he would have escorts. It says sometimes making $600 charges against his card several times a day. And then there's another guy named Stanley Tapscott, and who was part of the Washington Times, and here they are reporting on him. He said that he hadn't procured homosexual escorts. He said that he had talked to two women he arranged to meet through the escort service as part of a quote-unquote investigation of a dial-up porn service he had initiated a year earlier when he was editor of the newspaper's money section, but the editors knew of no such investigation.
That is crazy. It kind of reminds me of the Carlyle Group thing that you covered with the escorts, a little bit like that, especially with the money laundering through the limo service. And in this one, it's possibly through the funeral home. When you see multiple transactions on one person's credit card in one day, you have to wonder if they were purchasing not only for themselves, but maybe gifting other people.
Yes.
So, and those favors, you know, they go long and far.
And there were women also. It wasn't just all for gay men. But the thing is, it was lawyers, doctors, business executives, military officers from the U.S. and allied countries, including somebody who used the Department of Defense credit card. And the Pentagon was worried because for the past 8 years, military and civilian intelligence authorities had been concerned that there were a great deal of this going on at the top of the Reagan administration. They may have been penetrated by Soviet-backed espionage agents posing as male prostitutes.
So they go on to say that it was a sting and it's all made up and concocted by basically adversaries. You know, they say that just despite evidence, you know, it's a political opportunity, you know, we're just being ganged up on, and they hide behind that. The sad part of this is that not only were there boys involved allegedly, but the women, the 21-year-old victim, she stepped forward and was very confident in this case and gave a full testimony. She ends up getting charged with perjury.
Yeah. You know, and it's because they just want to keep people down, and they want to hide this. I mean, think about what is happening at these people that I'm naming. I mean, it just goes on and on and on and on. But how big of a deal? I mean, something like this going on now? It disappeared.
This was one of the biggest American scandals ever. And to this day, people still, they row over it because they're not satisfied that it has ever truly been, you know, satisfied if it happened or not.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously these things happen. I mean, they saw the credit card records and stuff like that. Now, you know, I think there's people who wonder sometimes about what happened in Omaha with the boys and the orphans and whether or not that came true. I mean, there was a person.
Yeah, and
who
that's what I'm referring to. The whole foster care, the filtering of very, very young children. You know, some of these people were 21 and up. Some of them are not.
Yeah, and one of the ones I think that was under, he sued Larry King and actually won some money on default judgment. But besides the default judgment, the person had to stand in front of the judge and explain exactly what went on. One of the things about that person is that he had been a convicted child molester, And he said that the only reason he molested children was because of what happened to him as a child at the hands of this Larry King guy. And it just, it boggles the mind when I look at this newspaper article from June 1989 and just goes on and on and on and talks about all of these things. And here's the other thing. Is operators of the ring, because these escorts were blackmailing all of these politicians and executives and things like that, which if you talk about security clearances or jobs or finding out insider information or whatever, but operators of the ring told the Times that videotapes, audio tapes, and still photographs were made of sex acts performed by clients, including what they call perverted acts. And it just...
Right, and that is going to be at least one of the tapes that Gunderson possibly got his hands on and maybe what got him killed. And then as these witnesses stepped forward, and like you said, they had to stand in front of the judge, talk about all the horrible things that happened to them. At the same time, you have the countering, which is, oh, this person just has multiple personality disorder. This girl's crazy. They're unreliable witnesses. They are discrediting them the entire time.
Yeah. And, you know, the thing is, so they had this raid of this house. And the reason there's like the Secret Service got involved, and they got involved because of the credit card fraud part. But where this all kind of went to crap is that because they were blackmailing all of these people, then all of a sudden it became they were the bad guys and not these political people who were doing these things with company credit cards and putting themselves in a position where it didn't look good and taking, you know, random people through the White House in the middle of the night. It's because they were blackmailing them. So then the next thing, you know, the Secret Service can go in there and they can shut everything down and they can keep quiet. And then the Secret Service agents, when they went in and raided this place, they took the financial records, they took the ledgers, they took the photos, they took the diaries, they took the telephone records, they took the Rolodexes, they took the client lists. And then, you know what? That stuff just disappears.
That's right. Men in black come in. You know, you didn't see anything. Nothing happened here.
Yep. And it just kind of disappears. Oh, names? No, we don't know any names or anything like that. It's the same with that madam in Washington, D.C. and her attorney who keeps trying to release the names of everybody on that list. And the judge keeps going, nope, not going to happen. We're not going to have any, you know, rich and famous and powerful people subjected to, you know, being exposed for, you know, being with prostitutes. That's just not important. It's the same kind of thing. So, and the thing is, this was the first time that the Secret Service has ever been involved in a raid like that. And then at first they denied that they were involved in the raid, but then they did a second one and people saw them. And so then they go, oh yeah, yeah, we did that. but we only, you know, this is the first time, you know, and they kind of hemmed and hawed, but then they just took everything away, everything. And, you know, and that's why people keep investigating. I mean, you and I could talk about this literally for the next three episodes.
This thing, it goes into multiple rabbit holes.
Yeah. And this is just kind of to show you what was going on in 87 and then 88 and these sex scandals that were rocking America that had all this upper kind of participation kind of thing involved. And just to show you that, and
that the honeypot operation was always alive and well.
Exactly. So I encourage anybody who wants to go dig deep and deep and deep on this Franklin, and you will go down some rabbit holes. But Jen and I just kind of wanted just to touch the bases of it. And just touching the bases of it takes forever because there's just so much information about it. Finder,
you and I sit down and look at something, I mean, there is a lot to go through. So, I mean, we give you as much as we can within an hour, but there's just so much more.
I know. Okay, you guys. So that's going to be it for the Finders and Franklin credit. But we will see you back here one more Friday in July. Jen, I hope that you have a wonderful weekend.
Thank you. You as well.
Okay. I will talk to you soon.
All right. Bye.
Bye, everybody.